Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Good morning, investors. NVIDIA Corp agreed to buy SoftBank Group's chip division Arm Limited for $40 billion, taking control of some of the most widely used electronics technology in the semiconductor industry's largest ever deal. So, will NVIDIA's ARM purchase be another step in the execution of a strategy to accelerate computing in any technology sector that NVIDIA touches, including gaming, autonomous vehicles, AI, scientific computing? What do investors need to know here? Battery Day for Tesla. It's coming up in less than a fortnight, and founder Elon Musk has hinted Tesla may be able to produce long-life batteries. So, what are investors looking out for ahead of and on Battery Day? Its stock fell when a short seller called its technology into question. We're going to take a look at Nikola. Are bearish investors still selling it? Meanwhile, Maybank Kim Eng has downgraded its sector outlook on ASEAN banks to negative, saying their operational recovery may be limited. What could this mean for domestic ASEAN banks in particular? Meanwhile, in news from Jackson Hole, the Fed has signaled the outlook is uncertain and stimulus is essential. It concluded its two-day meeting by holding the line, many investors thought it would, by voting to keep short-term interest rates anchored near zero, adjusting its projections for GDP, employment and inflation. We've got a lot to get through. So let's start by welcoming Arun Pai. As always, our Thursday guest to speak with right here on Money and Me, his Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. How are you, Arun?
Good morning, Michelle. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing terrific. Let's start with Nikola. So its CEO says the deal is going to combine the most popular and the fastest ecosystem CPU in the world with the world's leading AI computing company. So help us understand, if this deal goes through, we're looking at potentially the largest semiconductor deal ever. What do you think this means for the semiconductor industry?
So it's amazing, right? Like, the number of research reports I've read about this potential acquisition makes it the leading AI platform in the world. And you can clearly see why. Like, NVIDIA primarily being focused on graphic processing units, making the chips for data centers, etc., ARM, massive IP licensing company. It's basically the fundamental blueprint in over 90% of smartphones that we are currently using. Apple, Broadcom, Qualcomm, you name it. Pretty much all of them pay some kind of license fee to ARM. Now, while obviously headlines-wise, this is fantastic, you know, a $40 billion potential acquisition in the semiconductor industry, which is already running extremely hot over the past couple of years. But the biggest question is the geopolitical risks, right? Like, will China agree to this transaction to take place? Now, NVIDIA CEO has come out saying, look, they're very familiar with Chinese regulators. Just in the beginning of this year, they acquired a company, an Israeli chip designer company, Mellanox. And for that, they also had to go through Chinese regulation. Now, you know, in all deference to that, the Israeli chip designer company was a lot smaller than ARM. And I think that's going to be a big question mark, especially if, you know, the U.S. can start, once the acquisition takes place, and the U.S. can start imposing the kind of sanctions it does on Huawei, for example, right? And like all sorts of U.S. technology to be used by Chinese companies. What if they do the same thing with ARM's technology? When SoftBank acquired it, I think 3 or 4 years ago, there were none of these issues because, you know, okay, it's SoftBank, it's Japan, completely unrelated. There's no crazy geopolitical issues that are going on in the world. Mm-hmm. But now I think it might be a much bigger question mark whether the deal can actually go through or not. And I wouldn't assign more than like a 50-50% probability to that.
Really interesting, that probability. But yes, I was reading Chinese state media, which has sounded the caution on NVIDIA's ARM purchase, the Chinese state op-ed calling it disturbing. Also, the UK's Labour Party has questioned if it is in UK workers' interest to see UK's ARM moving jobs to Silicon Valley, even though NVIDIA has said it will keep ARM's IP in the UK, I believe. So 50-50 chance of this happening, hey, for you?
I think so, because it's just too much risk for China to take in case it goes down the path of what the U.S. is doing to Huawei. Mm. And Huawei people themselves have escalated this up to Chinese government officials saying, look, you know, we've already have had one hand tied behind our back. If the U.S. enables or enforces ARM to not being able to like provide technology and provide the blueprint to of chips to Huawei also, then the company is as good as gone. So what way, shape, and form will this acquisition actually take place in? And that's something where, you know, maybe they'll start carving out certain aspects of what ARM delivers to companies, to semiconductor companies, to soft, mobile phone companies. As long as something ironclad can be put in place, then I guess it'll have the blessing of the Chinese government. But currently, given the distrust between the two governments, it actually is going to be quite a difficult acquisition to go through.
Got it. Let's break this down for investors. So if you're a gamer or you use cloud computing or anything else that has a graphics element to it, you've probably used an NVIDIA product. It is one of the world's fastest growing chip makers. And its shares were down last week, but they've more than doubled in value since the start of this year for NVIDIA. So based on the company's current business, Arun, and its prospects, do you think the valuation of it is justified?
So that's interesting, because any acquisition of such a massive scale, like if you go back to like the last 50 years, very few of them have actually turned out to be like massive success stories. It's just purely because of like, you know, internal company dynamics, politics, actual execution of a solid merger to take place. It isn't that easy. The only model that's kind of worked out well is the Berkshire Hathaway model of acquire a company, keep it independent, and, you know, you continue doing your thing in your way. We will just provide you capital if you require, if you need it for further growth. So when it comes to these companies, as long as in an execution capability, if they can try and keep things relatively status quo, yet at the same time try to bridge that intellectual bridge between the two engineers, between the two research scientists, etc., that might yield something quite powerful. Because, you know, NVIDIA wanting to get its foot in the door in the CPU segment, ARM has that the qualifications and quality for that. Mm. But yet right now, if you look at the CPU market, Intel has like a market share of over, I think, like 90% or something. So if this combination enables this larger, potentially smarter company to take a much larger foothold in that, we can see Intel suffering, potentially. So from an investor point of view, I think there are a lot of question marks right now, right? Like, even if this acquisition even does go through, I think that's the first biggest hurdle.
Yep.
After that, to see how the execution takes place of the merger, whether they can truly break into the CPU market and displace Intel. And I think if that shows green shoots, then I think this combined entity becomes suddenly something very, very valuable to investors.
Okay, I want to push you a little on the investor perspective. So the semiconductor industry is a $400 to $500 billion US dollar market. There are a number of other companies competing in this space. There's MediaTek, there's Samsung, there's Huawei, all competing in the 5G chip space. There's also AMD. You mentioned Intel, there's Broadcom, Qualcomm. In your view, where do you see the best value?
To me, NVIDIA was a really solid buy for a really long time. I think right now the valuations are probably a little bit stretched. And then you combine that with this uncertainty of this acquisition, I think it's quite fairly priced. In terms of other, like these extremely large market cap companies, I personally have taken a little bit of a stance of a more cautious approach. And I would rather take a look at the more locally grown Singaporean companies, like, you know, like a UMS Holdings or, you know, along those lines, rather than dabbling in like these extremely large market cap spaces.
All right. And just because you brought up Berkshire Hathaway, I have to throw in that, hey, you know, Berkshire Hathaway just made a quick $800 million on Snowflake surging IPO. And we know that Warren Buffett sort of used to mock this sort of quick deals. You know, he's the king of the buy and hold forever. Were you at all interested in the Snowflake IPO?
I mean, I wish I could get in at the IPO price looking at the rearview mirror, but no, it's a very interesting company. And to be honest, I didn't know about it until it was going for IPO.
Oh, recently. You should have listened to our show yesterday. We gave everybody a game plan.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
All right, moving on. 22nd September, that's battery day for Tesla. Tesla's shares have more than quadrupled this year. So what is battery day, Arun? And why are investors looking at it with such interest?
I think that's required, right? Because you can't value this company as a car company at something like $400+ billion unless it's going to disrupt a lot of other industries too. And I think that's been the big selling point for a lot of investors who've gone along this roller coaster ride of investing into Tesla shares, not thinking of it as a car company, but thinking of it as an energy industry business, right? And that makes obviously the target market size a lot larger, potential avenues of future revenue a lot more, rather than just a pure car manufacturing company. So I think from that perspective, Elon Musk, always being the extremely overhyping person for his own business, he's really hyped up this battery day where he claims that there are huge breakthroughs that he's created, not just for the amount of miles that his car can drive, but all sorts of other new inventions he's come up with in this energy storage device. And I think that's going to be the most interesting thing where people are really looking forward to, okay, you've kind of gone through this whole Model 3 mass producing electric cars, checkbox. A number of other aspects that he claimed that would pick up extremely well have not done so, you know, like the SUV or Model Y, etc. So the big question mark now is, if everyone is claiming that this company can suddenly become like $1 trillion or $2 trillion company, where do we see this growth coming from? Because if you look at like the last couple of months' numbers in terms of actual vehicle deliveries, there isn't that kind of crazy growth that you would expect from a, at last count, something like a 1,200 PE multiple company. So if the revenue growth is not coming from just selling more Model 3s, because now it's become like a relatively more saturated market, you have Volvo coming out with a really good Polestar, Toyota, a number of other companies that have come up with their equivalent, and cars that are doing quite well, for that matter, right, in terms of numbers, if you look at like sales in Europe and Norway especially. So I think this is going to be very interesting to see for investors, whether he can actually live up to his hype of transitioning Tesla from a pure car manufacturing to an energy business. And I think that's what's so interesting and what is making the battery day so important to investors.
You know, I've heard investors say they are planning to buy every dip in Tesla in the run-up to 22nd September battery day. So given what you read of it, do you expect investors to bid up or sell down Tesla shares in the lead-up to this battery day?
Honestly, it's such a story stock with so many literally like fanatics behind it that I would not be surprised to hear statements like this come out, right? Like, I think there was a recent Portnoy Twitter video where he was like, remember the time when people were talking about Tesla going down? And you can see that in the volatility of the share, right? Like, this is a $500 billion market cap that was trading at like, you know, 510 or something billion dollars. It crashed down by like over 25% or something like that. And then it's like rallied all the way back up to relatively close to like all-time highs again. So this is something that's not trading on any kind of valuation or multiples. This is purely a supply-demand momentum stock. People are coming in, coming out, be it South Korean retail investors, be it American Robinhood investors, across the board. Like, it's just such a risky stock, in my humble opinion, that as a prudent value investor, you either have the view that this is going to be a $2 trillion stock over the next 5-10 years, and hence you don't care about it going up or down 20-30%, But I think statements like, you know, up till the battery day, if it goes down another 3%, I'm going to buy it. It's pointless because this is a stock that moves 10, 20% over the course of 2 weeks. So, you know, I think it's a lot more important to take a much more longer term view in this stock. And for that matter, pretty much any stock. But especially a company like this, where the range of outcomes can be, you know, given the fact that he's raised so much capital, bankruptcy is a very, very small probability of it happening. But it coming back down to more, coming back down to earth in terms of valuation of maybe, say, like $30, $40 billion, so like a 90% drop, or this escalating another 3 or 4 times from here up to a $2 trillion stock, the range is just so massive. People should not be going for like trying to chase that 2% or 5% yield.
Sounding a word of caution there, he's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Nikola, speaking of electric vehicles, shares of Nikola Corp yesterday reversed course to trade up as much as 6% from pre-market losses, resulting in some $24 million in mark-to-market losses for those betting against the stock. This according to S3 Partners. So when you look at Nikola, what a tangled thread we weave, huh? Oh my goodness.
Indeed.
The U.S. Department of Justice making inquiries into claims leveled against the truck maker. So help us understand details of a possible securities fraud and the link with the propulsion of an electric truck.
So, you know, on the back of Tesla's massive share price rally, a number of other companies, be it in the electric space or in the hydrogen space or the fuel cell space, had insane amounts of rallies too. And coming to Nikola specifically, I think it was late last week or early this week, I don't quite remember, but Hindenburg came up with this short report where they claimed that this was a massive fraud. You know, the videos of the hydrogen-powered truck that had come out is all fake, et cetera, et cetera. And then the founder of the company, he's an equally like loudmouthed, I should say, or very vocal person like Elon Musk. He came up with all these tweets saying that, you know, no one knows what they're talking about. This is just pure market like speculation where these short sellers are just talking their book. They're already short the share. They come up with this research report, quote unquote, trying to like drive the share price down. And to a large extent, it actually did happen. But I think the big question mark now is the business model is quite interesting, right? Where listening to a couple of venture capital firms that are on the board of this business, they try to sell this whole story that this is, again, not a car manufacturing company, because everyone knows that the margins of that is extremely minimal. But what they're trying to do is create this huge, like a hydrogen supply ecosystem kind of a business where, sure, they'll manufacture the cars. Sure, they will set up the infrastructure of, you know, rather than like a gas station that we go to fill up our petrol or diesel powered or fueled cars, they will set up this huge infrastructure where you rent a car or a truck from us that's hydrogen powered, and you can go to like these gas stations or hydrogen stations and top it up. So it's this kind of ecosystem that they're looking to create, which at least the venture capital firms are trying to justify the extremely inflated valuation based on traditional metrics. So there's this big hoo-ha now where a very qualified, I should say, short research company has come up with its thesis saying, look, you know, this whole example of GM taking a stake in Nikola and hence manufacturing its trucks, et cetera, it matters kind of nothing because, you know, they take us back to this example of Theranos, right? This huge healthcare fake company where Walgreens, Safeways, Cleveland Clinic, top-notch, tier-one pharmaceutical companies and distribution channels in the healthcare space, they partnered up with Theranos. So the fact that GM does with Nikola, you know, you never truly know. Is this just a purely story stock or not? I think this could be a very interesting HBO documentary in 6 months' time.
I think you're right. I'm already on Trevor Milton's Twitter feed, and I am amazed that he's saying half the things, ranting against what he calls the haters, saying, you know, the company is going to come back stronger from the lies spread about them. And interesting you bring up Theranos, because Elizabeth Holmes could be seeking mental disease as a defense at her Theranos trial. So who knows where these stories descend to, right?
Indeed. A great documentary. I'll just leave it at that, I guess, right? It'll be fun to watch leaping around on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon.
All right, let's take a look at the U.S. Federal Reserve. They wrapped up a two-day meeting overnight, and while as expected, there was no change in rates. After all, they're practically zero. Where could they go? They did formalize the lower for longer bit to 2023. So, help us understand, with those interest rates, the Fed short-term rate target set at 0 to 0.25%. Arun, is this enough to support a continued rally?
As you rightfully mentioned, this was pretty much an as-expected play. I think there were some market participants that were hoping the Fed would come out and say that they're going to be purchasing more bonds to try and keep yields, especially in the back end, even lower than where they are right now, which are basically all-time lows. But I think that was a bit of a, you know, hopeful expectation rather than something that's a little bit more realistic. So from the perspective of, it's basically like a blank check for even more inflated asset prices for, you know, the Fed has come out saying, look, we don't even expect inflation to come even close to our 2% level until 2023 now. So, and even if it does, don't worry about it. We will not ruin the party. We will not take away the punch bowl from the party. Investors, you guys have like basically like a blank check to some extent from our perspective, which is interesting. And, you know, like I read a couple of investors who said that if the Fed had a way to ensure that equity valuations and the bubbles that are being created in the asset prices can be deflated, but yet keeping interest rates as low as they are, they would definitely do that. But in the very, very difficult position that they're in right now, where unemployment is over 8%, who knows what the Congress, or for that matter, governments across the world are going to do when these existing debt moratoriums run out, they have no choice from their perspective but to keep interest rates basically zero and tell the market, don't worry, we are with you. We don't even mind if inflation shoots higher than what our local domestic requirements or expectations are. In the U.S. case, it's 2%. Even if it overshoots that, that's completely fine. So I think that's pretty much all they can do. It's interesting to see a little bit more of like the social element creeping into central banks, not just in the Federal Reserve, but even the ECB, where they're talking about how, you know, given the social economic income inequality or inequality, I should say, they're looking to ensure that unemployment rates, even for the less affluent masses, improve to a certain extent, which is something that you would traditionally hear ministers and people who are elected into government saying things like that.
Right.
So it was kind of interesting to see some central banks coming up with something like this. And what the long-term effects of that are going to be, especially when they should be completely apolitical, I think that's a big question mark. And I was reading a couple of interesting articles about this on Bloomberg and SCMP, et cetera. So I think that's something interesting to look out for in the long run. In terms of the investors, though, coming back on track to this topic, you know, valuations are sky high. Given that interest rates are going to remain at zero for the next 3 years, there easily could be another run-up in stock prices, at least.
Before we let you go, let's take a quick look at Maybank Kim Eng downgrading its sector outlook on ASEAN banks to negative, saying that their asset quality risks remain high and their operational recovery may be limited. What do you think this means for banks with a domestic focus?
So this is interesting, right? Like at Snow, where we deal with like the NPL space of banks, multi-finance companies, and fintech on the consumer unsecured side, we are clearly seeing a lot of stress in the market where a number of partners that we are dealing with, a lot of conversations going on about looking how to clean up their balance sheet, how to sell off these loans to market players such as us, etc. And I think Maybank kind of hit the nail on the head with that aspect where it is, you know, NPLs, right? Like that's the biggest factor that is stressing banks' balance sheets, especially when the debt moratoriums end, which various governments have imposed in their local market economies. Malaysia, Singapore, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, across the board, Europe, US, everywhere, right? Like all of these forgiveness plans where they kind of like kick the can down the road will come down to roost come October till I would say Q1 end of 2021, where now people have to start making these loan payments, SMEs, corporates, consumers, etc. And when that starts shaping out, it'll be very difficult for banks who might have stretched balance sheets already, especially in places, I would say, like India and Indonesia, where they were already dealing with such a large-ish NPL problem, to be having this come to roost too. So I think from an investor perspective, I am only looking at bank stocks in the US and Singapore because I think their balance sheets are like Fort Knox. And valuations of the banking sector across the board, this is not something new, right? Like the sort of NPL operational issues of lockdowns happening in certain cities or in certain countries, et cetera. It's nothing new. Like interest margin shrinking, loan growth is going to be slower. This has already been baked into the share price to a very large extent. A number of banks are trading at like fractions of their book value. Europe is a great example. There are banks that are trading at like 0.5 price to book. Would I, as an investor, look at that? Me personally, I'm not, because I think they're more of value traps. Unlike, say, the US, where post the global financial crisis, the Fed and the Treasury forced banks to clean up their act, raise a bunch of capital, clean up your balance sheet, sell off all this bad debt. Europe, India, Indonesia, not so much. Singapore, again, I think fantastic balance sheet strength. DBS, I believe, is Maybank's number one pick, which I completely agree with. They seem to be at the cutting edge of not just technology, but in terms of balance sheet strength, too. So, yeah, I guess that's a brief overview of the banking sector, at least how I look at it across the world.
Fantastic insights, as always. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Arun.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Michelle.
He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, joining me here in Money and Me.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg. or download the SPH Radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.